I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Two years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act and 11 months before he was murdered, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the difficulties of the next phase of the civil rights movement.
It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to get a program that will force the government to put billions of dollars into ending slums.
On this 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination, reflections from four people who continue his work: the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, the Reverend Dr. C. Anthony Hunt, Maisha Braden of the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law, and Congressman Elijah Cummings. They join me on Midday, right after the news. And good afternoon. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us today. Today, of course, marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was shot to death on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. The 39-year-old father of four had traveled to Memphis to lend his support to the city's black sanitation workers who had organized a strike to protest inhumane and dangerous working conditions, racial discrimination, and low wages. Coming up later in the program, I'll speak with Congressman Elijah Cummings, but we'll begin today with reflections on the legacy of Dr. King with three people who continue his work. The Reverend Dr. Heber Brown is the senior pastor of Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore and the founder of the Black Church Food Security Network and a Writers Cross Freedom School. Dr. Brown, good to see you again, sir.
Thanks so much for having me.
Maisha Braden is an attorney. She's a former prosecutor in the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department, who's also served during the Obama administration as a senior policy advisor in the White House Domestic Policy Council and the Office of National Drug Control Policy. She's now the director of the Criminal Justice Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and she joins us on the line from Washington. Ms. Braden, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
And the Reverend Dr. C. Anthony Hunt is the senior pastor of Epworth United Methodist Chapel in Baltimore County. He is the author of 8 books, including Blessed Are the Peacemakers, a theological analysis of the thought of Howard Thurman and Martin Luther King Jr. He teaches at St. Mary's Seminary and University, and he's a scholar of Dr. King and the civil rights movement. Dr. Hunt, welcome to the show as well.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
We are streaming our conversation on Facebook Live on the WYPR Facebook page. And a little later in the program, we'll take your calls and emails. And a reminder that Maisha Braden joins us from Washington. So you won't see Maisha Braden, but you will hear her. Dr. Hunt, let me start with you. You've done a lot of work on Dr. King's notion of the beloved community. Tell us what that is and what your notion of where of the status of the beloved community today.
Okay, in a rather short order, the beloved community is really, I see it as our hope for the world. It is a universal principle that Dr. King embraced throughout his life and his public ministry as the hope, the dream that he shared and was really embodied in his famous speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28, 1963, where he stated those famous words over and over again, "I have a dream." So it's the hope that we would live in community, that we would be community. In many ways, it's been lived into, and we've made a considerable amount of progress over the years toward beloved community, and yet at the same time, and more the more recent years, perhaps the last decade, we are seeing challenges across society and even within the context of religious communities to what beloved community is. But it is our striving to be all that we ought to be as a human family.
And Dr. Heber Brown, when Dr. King started the Poor People's Campaign in the months before his passing, he made a point to involve people outside of the African-American community, Latinos, Chicanos, Asian-Americans. The beloved community was all-inclusive. But of course, he grew out of, this was, you know, 4 years after the Freedom Schools, of the Freedom Summer in 1964. You have founded a Freedom School right here in Baltimore. Tell us about that school and what the philosophy behind it is.
Yeah, so really in many ways inspired by Freedom Summer of 64 and the Freedom Schools then, and so many other similar liberatory educational programs prior to that time, I founded the Oritas Cross Freedom School, just acknowledging that many of the same reasons that prompted the establishment of the Freedom Schools of the 60s, those same reasons are still here today in terms of education not being fully aligned with the needs of the students and the community as a whole. And also a great need and hunger that we see, particularly in Black youth, to be aligned with their ancestral and cultural identity. Who am I? After you've now made me expert on Napoleon and Christopher Columbus and everybody else and tested me on European and Western history, how about who am I? Who did God make me to be, if we'd say it in religious language? And so Oritas Cross Freedom School in that way lifts up, yes, Dr. King, but so many others that our young people are hungry to know and to be inspired by their example as well. I'll say finally, we open Freedom School on days when public school is closed. And so, for instance, last week was spring break. We had 5 straight days of Freedom School at my church. And then every other professional development day, where the school system is closed, we also open the church and we make the church a school for a type of hands-on, interactive, African-centered learning experience.
And it's because of the deficit of Afrocentric perspective in the history classes, in social studies classes, even in STEM classes, English and math. It's that deficit that you're acting to address.
Actually, that deficit, and also too, a different kind of learning experience in terms of a more egalitarian learning experience. And so, for example, last week, some of our children actually were teaching classes. We have one 9-year-old who speaks Spanish fluently, and so she taught Spanish class to her peers. We had another who has written extensively, loves to write. She taught a creative writing course at 11 years old. And so we have our young people also teaching so that they tap into their own genius. We'll remember classes like home ec and the like in school, and we know that many of those classes don't exist anymore, but there was some great stuff going on in home ec and shop, and so we bring a lot of hands-on learning too. They learn how to cook. We have 12 sewing machines. They learn how to sew. We're going to be doing something in the way of changing the oil and changing the tire, like those basic skills that you can take anywhere in life.
Yeah, and Maisha Braden, you have a long career at the Department of Justice, and now you're with an organization called the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law. Tell us what that organization is dedicated to and the work that specifically you're doing.
Thank you. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law was established in 1963 after Attorney General Robert Kennedy and President Kennedy took a look at what was happening, particularly in the South, as it related to civil rights. They thought that the fight needed to happen in the courtrooms, and some amazing work was being done by Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP, but more work needed to be done. So they issued a call to 250 of the country's best attorneys, brought them into the White House, and said, you need to bring your talents and your skills to bear in this civil rights fight. You need to be a part of the game in ensuring civil rights for African Americans in particular. And that is how we were founded. The individuals who attended that meeting went on to establish the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law with constant support from Robert F. Kennedy and his Justice Department. And we continue to do that work today through the aid of our pro bono law firm partners. We bring litigation when individual civil rights have been violated. We try and push the envelope as far as policy is concerned to make sure that policy that is coming out of Congress, out of state houses, out of the White House is pushing forward a civil rights agenda, ensuring equality and equal justice for all. And with the Criminal Justice Project of the Lawyers Committee, which was established Almost exactly 1 year ago, we are specifically focused on mass incarceration and the criminalization of poverty. And as you all know, the poverty campaign was where Martin Luther King Jr. was headed at the time of his assassination, looking at how American life was different for individuals who were poor, making sure that individuals who were poor were not left behind, and that we were actually making strides to change the culture of our country to ensure that poor people had a fair shot.
And in those very troubled times, the year in which Dr. King was murdered, of course, after his murder, more than 100 riots broke out across the country. Mm-hmm. But the year before, 1967, there were 80 different cities that experienced mm-hmm. violence. There was an article, ended up being the last thing that Dr. King published. It was published 2 days after his death in Look magazine. And he wrote in part, "The policy of the federal government is to play Russian roulette with riots. It is prepared to gamble another summer of disasters. In spite of two consecutive summers of violence, not a single basic cause of riots has been corrected. All of the misery that stoked the flames of rage and rebellion remains undiminished, with unemployment, intolerable housing, discriminatory education scourge in Negro ghettos. Congress and the administration still tinker with trivial, half-hearted measures. Yet only a few years ago, there was a discernible, if limited, progress through nonviolence." Reverend Hunt, what he's talking about is the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, mm-hmm. which passed in 1965 and 64, respectively. Mm-hmm. I read that, you know, and I thought to myself, this could have been written mm-hmm. a month ago.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I mean, sure. Have things changed? I mean, and here in Baltimore, of course, we experienced another uprising,
2015.
Just 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and Dr. King really summed up that statement with something he said on a number of occasions, that riots and uprisings, however we characterize them, are the voice of the unheard. And so, in this day, if we fast forward, we see it. We saw it in Ferguson. We see it in as a resultant. Outcomes of police brutality. We see it with what's gone on in Charlottesville, and so his words ring true today. That the kind of social upheaval we now see, chaos, if you will, in many respects, and the voicing out of those who feel unheard across spectra of our society, not just Black youth, but women. Those who are marginalized economically. And so Dr. King's concern to get to the root causes of social upheaval, separation and poverty, and lack of wealth distribution, racism and marginalization of immigrants in our society, as well as militarism and what we now see in terrorism, both domestic and, if you will, foreign, bring a rather interesting, if not toxic, mix to the concerns that we have as a society. And so Dr. King would speak probably the same words in very similar ways today if he were here.
Yeah, and Dr. Brown, I mean, he talked about the three pillars, the three yes. evils that he was working against: racism, poverty, and militarism. Just yesterday, we had the President of the United States saying he's going to send the military. He used the term the military. Perhaps it'll be the National Guard to the southern border of the United States. Systemic racism is something that we've been talking about for years, perhaps it's gotten a little more focus since the upheavals in 2015. The balance between an Afrocentric approach to that yeah. and an approach that involves everybody. You know, in the letter to the Birmingham from the Birmingham jail, Dr. King said part of the problem is white moderates who are more interested in order than in justice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I'm fascinated in that same line. I think one of the ways that I attempt to honor Dr. King is by honoring his evolution and evolution of his thought. And I read just this morning, he wrote a piece in, I think, June 67, called Black Power Defined, really in response to some of those young people in the day, like Stokely Carmichael and others who were pushing him there, mm-hmm. right? And it was fascinating for me to read in this article from King how he critiqued the strategy of marching in the streets in the nonviolent peace and saying that perhaps in our eagerness to see change happen, we made the marching too much of the centerpiece of our efforts and that it fell woefully short. And so for me, I try to study as much as I can the steps and the critique that King makes even of himself and their strategy and tactics. And so our African-centered Freedom School and even the Black Church Food Security Network is not necessarily efforts that are anchored by the politics of governmental reform, like reforming politics. It really is more so centered on, okay, what do historically marginalized communities already have, and how can we use what we already have to help to achieve some of the things that we need for our community? Not to say that the efforts of political reform need to diminish or decrease, but it is to say that if laws and legislation is the only path where energy gets directed, then we're going to fall short, at least based on what King said in 67.
Mm-hmm. And Maisha Braden, when it comes to the law, of course, you know, Dr. King famously said justice delayed is justice denied. People are thinking about that again just in these last couple of weeks where the police officers who shot Alton Sterling to death in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the prosecutor down there in Baton Rouge has decided not to prosecute those two individuals. Stephen Clark in Sacramento, California, another unarmed young Black man who was shot to death in the backyard of his grandmother's house. Circumstances about that, you know, again, somewhat unclear to a certain extent, but there is this sense that things aren't getting better since Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri 3 years ago. What's your take on where things stand, but particularly in the issue of police misconduct and police brutality?
I think Dr. King made clear that the first part of the civil rights movement, and that is the actual passage of legislation, was the easier lift. The more difficult lift was going to be the cultural shift, that actually required an institutionalized racism to dissipate, for people to let go of the things that they were comfortable with. You know, it didn't cost anything to pass a law. It didn't cost anything to integrate. But there's a cost letting go of systems that you depend upon and systems that make you comfortable. And I think policing is a good example of that. The response to movements from the 1960s civil rights movement to what's happening currently in the Black Lives Matter movement has been an increase in police use of force. We saw that with the riots that were happening in 1967 that you mentioned earlier. A lot of that was in response to people saying, okay, you've got your law, now go home and be quiet. But people asking for more caused a great deal of discomfort. And in the policing context, you have individuals who are moving based on what the Supreme Court has determined is a reasonableness standard, the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness standard. So it's not easy for people to understand why are individuals being shot and police officers are not being held responsible. And you have one side of the fence saying, well, you know, police are simply doing their jobs. If you would be more law and order about the way that you conduct yourself and obey rules, everything would be fine. Kind of telling people you have no reason to be upset. And I think Dr. King made clear it's purposeless to tell Negroes that they should not be enraged when they should be. And we are seeing that happen right now. We are seeing police being resistant with a great deal of support from this current White House to change that has been clear from the efforts of many researchers who determine that policing cannot move forward. Police cannot effectively do their job if the community sees them as illegitimate. And the progress that was being made toward the end of the Obama administration seems to have been rolled back. You have a Justice Department that is entirely resistant to police reform. You have a Justice Department that is resistant to doing anything to say, look, law enforcement, look, police, you have to do better. You are the guardians of our Constitution. Our constitutional rights don't mean anything if the police are allowed to violate these laws at will. And it is right that people are upset. It's right that people are protesting. And it's right that people feel that progress has not been made, because this is the long, tough slog of the civil rights movement. It's been 50 years, and we have only made very, very small steps. We've made some progress, but not enough progress.
Maisha Braden is the director for the Criminal Justice Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Dr. Heber Brown is the founder of Aretha's Cross Freedom School and the Black Church Food Security Network. He's the senior pastor at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church. Reverend C. Anthony Hunt is a scholar of Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement and the pastor of Epworth Methodist Chapel. We'll have more on Dr. King's legacy when we return to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Stay with us. Matt, and thanks to everybody who's tuning in to Midday Today. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz. He's the director of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, she's the film critic for the Washington Post, plus theater critic J. Wynn Russick, will review La Llorona, the new show at the Cohesion Theater Company. Later in our program today, I'll speak with Congressman Elijah Cummings. By the way, his annual job fair is coming up on Saturday at Morgan State University. If you're just joining us, we are speaking about social justice and civil rights in America as we reflect on the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Today is the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. My guests are attorney Maisha Braden, the director for the Criminal Justice Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown III, the executive director of the Black Church Food Security Network and the founder of Aretha's Cross Freedom School, and the scholar and author, the Reverend Dr. C. Anthony Hunt. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. Reverend Hunt, a poll that was just written about a week or so ago here in the Baltimore Afro, 1 in 10 African Americans think that the United States has achieved all or most of the goals of the civil rights movement under Dr. King. That's 1 in 10.
Yes.
Is that your take? And I mean, is there a sense, particularly with given the current political climate and the election that we had in 2016 at the federal level, what's your take on the mood of the Black community?
Well, I'd reframe the question with a response that there's a perception difference in among white and Black persons in America, where I heard a different poll a couple of days ago where the majority of white citizens believe that we've made some considerable progress and that there is in the 60-70% range that there's no large racial concern in America, where, you know, 80-90% of African Americans feel the exact way that you've pointed to. So I would tend to lean toward, you know, toward that 10% that you've cited, given the disparities again in wealth distribution, given the real issues related to aggression and microaggression on a daily basis, given to, for example, having to have talks with my adult children about the potential of racial violence in Baltimore and the surrounding area. So these are real concerns among Black, and brown persons in America and people of color and racial and religious minorities as well.
And Reverend Brown, John Lewis, the great congressman from Georgia, one of the great colleagues of Dr. King as a young man with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Mm-hmm. When Barack Obama was elected president, I guess it was the day after Martin Luther King's birthday in 2009, that's when his inauguration was, Congressman Lewis said that Barack Obama is what's at the end of that bridge in Selma, the Pettus Bridge, that there was clearly a mood of exultation and optimism with the election of the first president of African descent. And there are those who say that part of the narrative of what happened in 2016 when Donald Trump was elected, that it was a reaction to the fact that America had elected its first black president. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting when I think about Congressman Lewis and so many others who were compatriots and comrades to King during that time. There's no way that I could feel the fullness of what they felt given their journey in that time period of life. You know, I honor how that generation really felt about Obama and still feels about Obama, former President Obama at this time. And at the same time, there's a rising generation similar to the same thing that happened with King and Stokely on that Mississippi road. You saw black power and you saw nonviolent direct action walking side by side. And I was just watching the documentary today on King in the Wilderness.
Yeah.
And the reporter in the middle taking the mic back and forth between these two representatives of different generations. And I am of the generation that says it's been a long time anchoring our efforts on either moral arguments alone or on legislative and legal politics alone. There's got to be another way to bring some energy to the table as well. And so, you know, with having black churches use land they already own to grow food and having pastors use buildings that Monday through Saturday sit underutilized or not utilized at all, these are things we have in the current inventory that doesn't take a law being passed. It doesn't take a moral argument being made. It just takes the preacher having the key and opening the door or trustees saying, yes, let's grow food. Our community needs food. So that's where I am. And I think with Trump, I think that it only sharpens those kinds of approaches to how we can bring about change, because there's a mood amongst many of those who work for legislative reform and trying to get various bills passed. There's a feeling among some that say it's going to be slim pickings for the next few years to get anything of substance passed. And so in the meantime, do we sit and twiddle our thumbs, or do we take what we have, do what we must, not only for ourselves, but for our children?
And Maisha Braden, you know, the particularly the assault on voting rights and the assault on the ease in which citizens can vote is something that people have been talking about, not just in the Trump administration, but from well before the Trump administration. The New York Times has an editorial this week that says poll taxes and literacy tests have given way to voter ID laws, cutbacks to early voting and same-day registration, polling place closing, voter roll purges, and racially discriminatory redistricting, as well as felon disenfranchisement. Maish Braden, in the scope of things at your work, are you doing any work in the voting rights area, and where do those efforts stand? And as you said, we've got an administration that seems pretty antithetical to police reform. They certainly are equally antithetical to voting reform.
Absolutely. Voting has been the lifeblood of the work that the Lawyers Committee is doing. We currently have litigation pending in Texas. We've had litigation in Georgia. We have litigation in Alabama. The push for the ballot is at the heart of what we do, because that is the nucleus from which all other rights extend. And actually, there's an article, CNN printed an article today from Kristen Clark, our president and executive director, focusing on the importance of the vote and remembering the importance of the vote as we memorialize this 50th anniversary. Something else to remember, however, as it relates to voting, individuals who have been stopped and questioned by police, it has been demonstrated, are less likely to go to cast a ballot. Most recently, Philip Alston, who is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, in doing a tour of the United States, found that our current criminal justice system was serving as a mechanism for recycling people into a system of poverty. And as a result of that recycling, individuals were disengaging from democratic processes. So when we talk about voting and the importance of the right to vote, we have to remember it's not just access to the ballot. It is creating within people a knowledge and a passion for casting the vote and understanding that that is their opportunity. That is their primary opportunity to exercise citizenship and to have some semblance of control over the things that are happening to them in their community. If you don't like your police chief, if you don't like the laws that are happening, you have to look at the person who is responsible for appointing those individuals. And those are often elected officials.
And Reverend Hunt, there's a piece in today's Wall Street Journal by an African-American conservative columnist named Jason Riley. Mm-hmm. And he says that it's a knee-jerk reaction on the left to blame all of the problems in communities of color on systemic racism, whereby attitudes towards marriage, towards education, towards work, and the rule of law play a much larger role than the left wants to acknowledge. How do you respond to that point of view?
Well, my response is that we to deal with the issues of racial and class disparity in America, we have to look at the root causes, and those root causes do go back historically for black persons in America in general to slavery. And so the problem in America, and W.E.B. Du Bois stated it clearly in 1903, is a problem of the color line. And I often say that the elephant in America's room, and it's been born. It was born in the last election cycle, the 2016 election cycle, and it's being played out now in a politics of fear, race, and divisiveness that is seen from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and across America. Is the elephant in America's living room is the problem of race. And so until we deal with the root problem and the systemic issues, it doesn't serve us well to point to a sole responsibility of black persons taking care of themselves in a rather knee-jerk reaction. So that is, in my estimation, a rather simplistic way of looking at the historic racial political matters that attain to where we are as a society.
And Dr. Brown, what strikes me as I watched this movie you just referenced, the executive producer, one of the executive producers is Taylor Branch. Yeah. He lives right here in Baltimore. It's called King in the Wilderness, and it's streaming now on HBO, and mm-hmm. I can't recommend it highly enough. Mm-hmm. Is the radical nature of Dr. King's understanding of nonviolence, which he got a lot of pushback from, and when he extrapolated the nonviolence from the shores of America to the rice paddies of Vietnam and mm-hmm. the pushback he got from that, he called for a guaranteed annual income. Mm-hmm. He called for corporate boycotts the night before he died at yes. the Mason Temple in Memphis. He said, don't buy Coca-Cola. They don't hire people of color. Is that spirit of radicalism, that spirit of just sort of, you know, tenacious grasp of your philosophical belief alive and well?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I'm so glad you raised King at that stage and season of his mm-hmm. journey, mm-hmm. because that's the King we don't often let out of the closet to say anything. But that King was, you know, looking back on his own short life But looking back on his activities and seeing both his successes and also, you know, the shortcomings, I think it would bode well for us to study. And again, I agree with you in terms of watching that documentary. I think, you know, it really was enlightening on so many ways, including Mrs. Coretta Scott King's involvement, particularly when it came to anti-war campaigns as well. But looking at, listening to and looking at where the movement was headed at that point is instructive. And I think also other contemporaries of King, Fannie Lou Hamer, read and see what she was doing in the last maybe 6 to 8 years of her life. She moved to farming, food sovereignty, land sovereignty. Look at W.E.B. Du Bois, The Last Journey. So what I try to do, Tom, to cut it short, is I try to study the full length and breadth of the people who have been engaged in any process of social justice activism in this country and see how their ideas evolved and see where they ended and try to look at the baton that must be picked up from where they left off, as opposed to rehashing and rehearsing the same things they did, even when they say that those steps fell far short. And that's where King was. King was, you know, the boycott, selective buying campaigns, Operation Breadbasket, and the like. King's strategy was shifting, and I think we can fully honor him and push back against making him a caricature by honoring what he was saying at the last chapter of his journey, just as much as everything else.
And Maisha Braden, we want to give you the last word here. Dr. Brown talked about using those sanctuaries that are not used from Saturday to Monday in new and inventive ways. You are a veteran of the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. You have worked in the White House during the Obama administration. Is, in terms of legal strategies for people wishing to move the ball forward for social justice, are we in a sort of tread water situation here where we wait around until there's a change in administration, which couldn't happen any earlier than 2020. What is the sort of a strategy moving forward in these next 2 years when it comes to the legal approach to social justice issues?
I think the strategy is in the states. We can do our best to make sure that there are no laws passed that do harm, and to try and push back at this administration's efforts to roll back very important protections. But the federal government is not the be-all and the end-all. There, for those individuals in Maryland, I live in Maryland, what is happening in the state house? There's a criminal justice reform bill pending right now in Maryland.
SB 122, yep.
That's right. And individuals have to be engaged. The people of Baltimore are in a unique position. There's a new police commissioner who likes being engaged. He is committed to constitutional policing principles. Take advantage of that. Engage with him. Engage with the police department. If you don't like the police department's use of force policy, engage with the police department and encourage them to develop a use of force policy that you are satisfied with, because the power of any policing agency stems from the people. You've got to engage where you are, control what you can control. Start on the local level, work your way up to the statewide level, then work your way up regionally, and then try and focus on what's happening nationally. But to make a long story short, the answer is in the states, and we must become more engaged in statewide policy.
Maisha Braden is the director for the Criminal Justice Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. The Reverend Dr. Heber Brown is senior pastor at Pleasant Hope Baptist Church here in Baltimore. And the Reverend Dr. C. Anthony Hunt is senior pastor at Epworth United Methodist Chapel. Well, to spend time with you on this poignant and sad day has been an honor for me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Likewise.
All.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we've got more on Aretas Cross Freedom School, the Black Food Security Network, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and Dr. Hunt's books on our website, wypr.org/midday. By the way, tonight at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum for Maryland African American History and Culture, an event called Where Were You? There'll be a short film and a panel in which people share their memories of where they were when they heard that Dr. King had been killed. There will be performances by Femi the Dryfish and the actor Keith Snipes. It starts at 6:30. Come to our website for details. Coming up after a quick break, Congressman Elijah Cummings joins me. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.